So today we're talking about labor unions. Our guest is Joe Lewis Wildman, a longtime community organizer and labor union representative. I've known Joe since he came to Mendocino County to work with SEIU and the county and court workers in the early 1990s. I worked most of my adult professional career with SEIU throughout the state and retired from the union while working in Mendocino County. So Joe and I have spent many hours talking about unions and politics. His brilliant mind and acute perspectives and sense of humor always make for informative and thought-provoking conversations. So Joe, welcome to Corporations and Democracy, and thanks for joining us. Let's start with a bit about your background in politics and in organizing.
Okay. I have worked for the Democratic Party of Cook County. I worked for the chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Illinois Legislature. I was a janitor and active in my union, which has more to do with my career than any of that stuff. I've been an organizer for SEIU's International Union. That's what got me to Mendocino County, was there was an affiliation campaign for County Employees Association to join SEIU back in 92 and 93. I worked for State Senator Pat Wiggins in the Rules Committee of the Senate in California. I've run a lot of campaigns. I've run for office myself, not particularly destined to win, and had a good time. I'm on the executive board of the Democratic Party. I'm a socialist. I don't know. What else is there?
I know you came out of Chicago politics, which is very precinct-oriented, or you call it wards, I guess, there, huh?
Well, there are precincts within the ward.
I
was the acting ward secretary of the 49th ward, and we had, I think it was 54 precincts in the ward. It's just basically a city council district.
Uh-huh.
So,
okay, well, I wanted to talk a little bit about history of unions and give my perspective that I think the spirit of organized labor started to decline when the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, and the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, were merged in the early 50s, I believe that was. The AFL had traditionally been made up of skilled laborers, mostly white men, while the CIOs had a base of mostly unskilled migrant workers, immigrant workers, and women. The CIO leadership was displaced at that time, and many were deported as communists and otherwise radicals. And I believe to this day, with a few notable exceptions, labor unions in the U.S. are run by white men with relatively conservative bent, though I have to say union staff are some of the most dedicated and radical and idealistic people I know. So what's your view of how labor unions have declined in numbers and power in the U.S.? What's some of the factors of that?
Well, I think the internal identity of unions is a separate question from the decline in power, although I'm sure they're related because everything's related. But the internal self-definition and how unions see themselves clearly has moved from being a revolutionary force to being an organization in the labor business. There have been some notable leaders who, at least their rhetoric, was much more revolutionary than that. But at this point, everything's been sort of co-opted into process and the professionalization of representing workers as opposed to the democratic process of workers taking power. I think a lot of the decline of the power of unions has to do with the fact that it's one of the it's caused partially by their success in lifting enough people out of poverty to keep their unions going and thinking they're done. And people take a lot of stuff for granted that unions achieved. And now that they take it for granted, they aren't fighting to keep it, and they'll lose it. So I think unions in some ways are declining because of their own success, including things like winning grievance procedures. So instead of walking off the job and shutting down the factory, they now get tied up in paperwork. And there's just a whole direction of a group of professionals who bargain, which is way different than a group of workers who withhold their labor.
I'll say. What are some of the things that unions have accomplished that we all enjoy and don't recognize that it was workers' collective action that got it for us?
Well, you know, most people think of the obvious stuff like, you know, sick days, vacation, 40-hour week, you know, overtime provisions. But, you know, frankly, even the creation of OSHA,
occupational health and safety.
Equal pay for equal work is a struggle now, clearly led by labor unions. You know, there's just a lot of occupational health and safety kind of things. You know, but we also achieved due process rights in discipline and due process in grievances. And I think to some degree it lifted it a little out of the hands of the average worker on the floor. And unions have not spent enough time keeping it in the hands of workers on the floor, on the factory floor or the assessor's office or wherever the workers are.
Yeah, I really do agree with you that professional union staff, of which I was, you are yeah, part of the problem. Not our intentions, yeah, but because it does co-opt the power.
Well, you know, it's structurally inevitable unless you put other institutions into place. You hire somebody to work for the workers in the unit, and they want to show how good they are, and they want to win, and they lose sight of the fact that the workers need the win, not the rep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know anybody who takes pride in their work who wouldn't find themselves falling into that unless it is really clearly defined as their work being empowering members.
Right. So
then if you test them on that, how well did you empower the members? Show me evidence of how empowered the unit is. How many people have been through trainings on stewards? How many people handle grievances themselves? They would suddenly feel like complete failures and want to talk about the grievances they've won.
Right. Yeah, I know. I've been there. So how about labor and unions, which aren't necessarily the same thing, but are both important? How do you see them being impacted by the Trump administration, both in a positive and in a negative way, if you can think of examples of those?
Well, first of all, let me say that although Trump has filled our consciousness from day one, and he seems really dedicated to doing that, for the most part, it isn't Trump that's causing the problems for labor unions. I'd say it's Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, because it has much more to do with the Senate and the House. I mean, Mitch McConnell already made sure that there was not going to be a Barack Obama appointment to the Supreme Court. Now, Trump got to nominate Neil Gorsuch, but the fact that we have now a anti-union majority on the court was not Trump's doing. All Trump had to do was nominate someone he was told to. And McConnell held that seat open for an unprecedented period of time without even holding a hearing on Obama's nominee. And nobody should underestimate what this court is going to do to workers' safety, workers' rights, to organize, and the work of labor unions. We are now about to go onto a steep skid with Neil Gorsuch on the court. That's the big one. In terms of the National Labor Relations Board, people are in terms. There hasn't been a total turnover. Obama managed to finally get people appointed because McConnell had held up those appointments forever. But now, you know, now the board is not terrible. But, you know, it will be if it goes on long enough, trust me. So most of the damage that's been designed to do hasn't happened yet. It's just all getting set up.
And thank goodness that Ginsburg is hanging in.
Well, I expect there to be some very good dissents written. Unfortunately, it won't be the court opinion. It'll be the dissent.
Mm-hmm.
Although they play into reversals down the road. So,
do you think that the extreme right position of Trump's appointment, Gorsuch, is pushing some of the kind of right folks a little more to the center on the Supreme Court?
I don't. I'd like to be wrong. I think, you know, I mean, I don't think you can push Alito to the center. Alito is actively seeking out cases that can lose at every level to get to the Supreme Court so that he can overturn standing precedent. I mean, he's on a crusade to do that. He is searching for these cases. I think it's unethical, but that's why he's there. Thomas, I don't think, has two ethics to rub together for warmth. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard for this court to restrain itself. Now, there's the case right now, Janus versus AFSCME. And it's going to be really interesting to see where somebody like Roberts comes down on it, because Roberts does have some reasonable positions. And he's also done a lot of contortions to get to them on this court. And I don't think he's going to save anybody on this case. I think labor is going to lose a lot of its strength based on the decision in Janus v. AFSCME, which hasn't happened yet. It's been argued. I'm expecting it to come out in June. We'll find out.
And tell us about that issue.
So this is a guy named Janus who works for the state of Illinois, argues that paying his fees for service to the union is a violation of his First Amendment right to free speech, because he works for the state, and workers should not have somebody else, they should not be compelled to pay for the services of somebody else to represent them and speak for them. It's a violation of their First Amendment rights. And it's an interesting argument, but it has no basis in reality. I mean, we all pay for the other side of the table when we pay local taxes for them to hire a law firm and speak for all of us in bargaining. And the workers have a right to have somebody speak for them in bargaining. The basic argument of the Right to Work Foundation and the Pacific Legal Foundation and the usual suspects from the right is, what if he doesn't want a raise? What if he'd rather see that money go to something else in the government? Who is the union to come in and try to get him a raise?
Force a raise down his throat, huh?
Right, force a raise down his throat, because they're speaking for him, when in fact, if he could speak for himself, he would turn down the raise. And that might be true of him, but that's not how bargaining works. That's not what a bargaining unit is. And the courts have held over and over and over again historically that the public interest in orderly bargaining, in not having walkouts and strikes, in having people elected to represent the bargaining unit, have them represent the unit, come to agreements, that public interest in the orderly functioning of the government outweighs Mr. Janus's complaint about somebody else bargaining.
So if the court finds him in the right, and that would basically make the United States a right-to-work country.
Well, for public employees.
For public employees.
They did craft the argument that it's particularly First Amendment because the employer is a government agency.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's a hop, skip, and a jump. And the other thing to keep in mind is, as time has gone on, you know, public sector workers have only really had the right to bargain in large numbers for the last 20 years. It's not a long-standing thing. It used to be illegal for public employees to bargain in California until Myers-Milius Brown and the Dills Act and these laws that go back to all the way to the 1980s. They're not that old, and some of them were tied up in courts almost till the end of the 1980s. So this is not a long-standing right of public employees. But in that time, they've gone from being a small portion of the organized labor force to a large portion of the organized labor force, because during that time, manufacturing jobs left the country. But you can't exactly send public sector jobs to Mexico and South Korea. Plus, it's illegal for a public employer to spend taxpayer money to fight a union from existing. And they rarely violate that. I mean, I've run into it a few times with unfair labor practices. But in the private sector, they hire all kinds of union busters to break up unions, and they've been fairly successful. So the balance in the AFL-CIO has gone towards AFSCME and SEIU and away from the United Auto Workers and the steel workers because the jobs left the country. But the service jobs can't.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah.
So when they make it so that there isn't these fees anymore, you're going to see contraction in the labor movement. And the money that's spent to lobby for safety, to lobby for pensions, to lobby for that stuff just isn't going to be there.
Yeah, that will have a huge impact on all of us, because I know in areas where there is a high union workforce, that there's a good number of workers who are unionized, even the non-union jobs pay better, higher wages, more benefits, and so it right. lifts everyone, union and non-union.
Well, Lake County has a 1.5% sales tax measure on the ballot for the county areas, the unincorporated cities, to bring up the sales tax to the same level as Clear Lake and Lakeport. Okay, so all across the county, it'd be at the same level, and they've had a bunch of fires and disasters, and they kind of need the money. And, I think sales taxes are regressive. Nobody likes them. But they put this measure on the ballot. And the opposing argument that was put in basically said the average county worker makes $51,000 a year, but the average, a person in Lake County makes $36,000 a year. And that's compelling. But if they're arguing for bringing county workers down to $36,000 a year, they should be prepared for the non-unionized, non-public workers to go down to 24, because that's going to be the outcome of what they're arguing for. And I don't know why they think that's a good idea. If they don't get that the public sector employment, the postal workers, the teachers, the people who are making a living don't set a standard for wages in the county, they're missing the point.
Right, yeah. So aside from the Supreme Court's looming decision and some of these other things, what do you see labor's biggest struggles are currently in the country?
They're different for every group of workers. I mean, right now, prevailing wage, which has been a given, is under attack. Clearly, the whole right-to-work thing, where not only public employees but everybody would be able to... unions, this is kind of tricky, and I don't know how much I should go into the technical part of it. But when you... Traditionally, going back to the National Railroad Labor Relations Act, it was hard for employers to know who they're supposed to bargain with, because almost anybody could claim they speak for the workers. And that's why governments stepped in and said, okay, there's going to be an election for who speaks for the workers. And along with getting recognition for being the organization that gets to bargain on behalf of the workers, came an obligation to represent all the workers. If you're going to have the exclusive right to represent, you have the duty to represent. And for a long time, unions had to represent everybody, whether they were paying or not. And then there were a number of unions that tried things. Some of them held up in court, some didn't. Abood was a case about teachers in Detroit. And there was a decision that basically said unions can charge non-members for their representation. They can't make them join the union because people have a freedom of association. They certainly don't have to be a member. They don't have to own the union. They don't have to participate in the union. But they do have to pay, because the union has a legal obligation to bargain on their behalf and to enforce the contract on their behalf in grievances and, in many cases, discipline, particularly if discipline is a function of the contract as opposed to some function of another agency that regulates it. And that's been a standing thing. It's held up a bunch of challenges. That is what's going to go away in these court cases. And so it's a real struggle to maintain the duty to represent. Now, there are a lot of union people, and I bring this up in terms of a conflict in unions. A lot of people are saying, well, if they don't want to pay, we shouldn't bargain for them. We shouldn't represent them in grievances and discipline, which is contrary to the whole concept of the union. It's also really short-sighted, because if you can bargain a raise that only applies to union members and not non-members, what's to stop the employer from saying, well, we didn't reach an agreement. We're only going to give the raise to non-members. We'll keep bargaining with the members.
Yeah, it's
legally,
two-edged sword.
If you let them treat you separately, it doesn't mean they're going to treat you better. So we really have an obligation to hang together as a union. And I'm seeing a lot of discussions where I'm worried about the union movement tearing itself apart in a very short-sighted response to Janice V. AFSCME.
So what victories do you think are notable with unions? I know the fast food industry has been having some successes. I think Walmart workers weren't they able to unionize? Or
not across Walmart, but there is at least one union, Walmart, that I know of. And in the fast food industry, it actually hasn't been so much an organizing drive as it has been lobbying for increases in the minimum wage at the local level and the state level. And I don't think people know how much of the resources union has are actually put into improving the life of all working people and not just bargaining a contract. I mean, there's a lot of work from unions going into having comprehensive health care, you know, either single payer, Medicare for all, something. The nurses union is way out in front on that because they actually care about health care. Have there been victories there? There's been forward motion more than there's been setbacks. But until we have health care as a guaranteed right, I don't think we've quite gotten there. And, you know, I have to say, my psychological well-being depends on the little victories every day on behalf of individual workers that I win. Because I don't have my hands on the big victories right now. Now, when I was at the California United Home Care Workers, we got to get the state to say they're eligible for overtime. That was a big deal. And before I was doing that, organizing 70,000 home care workers in L.A., was a huge organizing success. It was the biggest since the United Auto Workers in the 30s. In fact, I think it was bigger. You know, there are still victories. They mostly don't make the radar of the news. I mean, you can watch television all day long and never see a character who's a union rep or a member going to a union meeting. You know, it's just not, that stuff is just not in the dominant culture, intentionally.
Yeah, I think that's true. You have a business section of a newspaper, but you don't have a labor section of the newspaper.
Right.
And there's many ways that unions, part of the whole propaganda machine of the country that is corporate dominated, certainly doesn't want to give any kudos to unions or acknowledge their benefit to everyone.
Well, you know, when you talk corporation and democracy, right, corporations actually are fairly democratic with their stockholders. The laws on stockholder democracy are actually pretty strong. They're just not advocating for democracy in the world for other people. And unions are democratic organizations. How successful they are as democratic organizations, how involved the members are, boy, does that vary a lot. And, boy, am I disappointed with it. But the mechanism is there for unions to be democratic organizations. And corporations don't like that. And by democratic, I don't mean the Democratic Party. You know, I'm with the operating engineers right now, and I want to say that the opinions being expressed here are my own, and not the leadership of the operating engineers. But I'm with the operating engineers, and right now they're having their elections. And people are running for union office, and the members elect them. Nobody just sneaks in. Now, they tend to vote for incumbents, just like everybody who votes for Congress, right? There's obviously weighted advantages in incumbency, like you have a record to run on, and victories to pound your chest about. But the members still get to run and still get to decide who's going to be the leadership.
Right. Okay, we're coming up on the middle of the show. It's 1:30, and if you'd like to get in on the conversations, talking about unions locally, nationally, the number is 895-2448. And our guest today is Joe Wildman, union staff and longtime community organizer and Politico. I think you have more, campaign logistical, savvy than anybody I've known. And,
I'm state of the art for 1975.
So what potential do you think that unions are overlooking or ignoring? What could they be doing now that they're not? And I know unions vary drastically from area regions and from international affiliations and all, but overall.
The problems there are now are the problems that have been plaguing organized labor since the merger of the AFL-CIO and longer, and they're just becoming more critical. I hate jurisdictional fights. I mean, you know, I'm with the operating engineers, and I go to a meeting of operating engineers, and the operators are complaining that the laborers keep getting on the equipment, and the employer's working them out of class, and you've got to stop that because they pay the laborers less than the equipment operators. But you really, you know, if you spend all your time fighting over whose jurisdiction the work is and all that, you're missing the point of expanding the work and helping the laborers get paid enough that they're not eager to jump on the equipment just to make a few bucks more, right? So we're not really pulling together as the House of Labor enough to make things better for everybody. We're still getting drawn into craft disputes and jurisdictional disputes that are almost comic if they weren't so sad sometimes. But, you know, there is an obligation of the people elected by the laborers to represent the interests of the laborers, and the equipment operators, and the electricians, and the carpenters, and we're divided into crafts, and it's part of the legacy of the AFL. The CIO being more about industrial organizing. You don't organize the equipment operators separate from the laborers, separate from the carpenters. You organize the construction industry. And we've never really gotten beyond those inherent conflicts and the incentives to do things wrong. That's just still there. And I don't have a cure for it, and I'm going to be retired, hopefully, before I ever get into a position to solve it, because I'm at the end of my career, not the beginning. Another thing we're overlooking
we have a couple calls. Can you hold on to that train of thought, and let's see what a few people want to say?
I can let it go, too, if there's something.
No, hold on that. Hold that train. Good afternoon, caller. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. It seems just as hello?
Hello, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I got that delay or something. Seems like if every trade had its own, employment office, you know, and they wouldn't have to get into, a union where all these laws, then you're excluding a bunch of people from working because they're not in the union. There's all these other things to tangle with and lobbyists, which shouldn't really even be there, I guess, seems like, taking over the government through lobbyists, because that's all money, and then there's people at the top of the union making money. Why don't they just say each trade could have its own employment office and deal with, and the laws, you could write the laws for everyone and exclude a lot of the BS that goes along with the unions. That's just what I was thinking about generally. And another, I was going to call into this other show about low-income housing and a credit union for just when you try to build a house, low income or whatever, there's all these really high costs. And why don't you just have a credit union that could just help with building houses for people and get them back in housing? And that's all I have to say. Thanks.
Great. Thanks for calling in.
All right. Bye.
Okay. You have any thoughts on that? Or there's two more lines ringing.
Unions don't exclude anybody from joining in the construction trade. You want to join, you join. You have to go through an apprenticeship program and prove you know how to operate the equipment or that you're a qualified electrician. And I don't know what it means for the different trades to run the employment office. The union runs the apprenticeship program. none of the contractors who do employment run their own apprenticeship program. That would be all expense and no income for them. Whereas the union has members who join and pay dues, and we run an apprenticeship program to keep the quality of the work up. So logistically, I don't know what it means for an employer to run the employment agency, except for it through the union, which is the members banding together and creating the employment agency. But we don't exclude people from joining. It's not like you have to be somebody's nephew or come with a letter. You show up and you want to be an equipment operator, you go through an apprenticeship program. We are showing up at high schools and begging people to become apprentices, because everybody wants folks to go to college. You follow the political debate and everything happens at college. Well, you know, you can learn a lot as an electrician and an equipment operator and make a decent living with a retirement. And frankly, the people going to college and getting their MBAs often are driving Lyft and Uber.
Okay, we got another call. Hello, caller, you're on the air. Hello? If you've got your radio on, you're going to get a delay, so you should turn it off. All right, well, we're going to go to another line. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hi. This is a great show.
Good.
Have I got an echo?
If you've got your radio on, you probably do have an echo.
No, I don't have my radio on.
Oh, well, you sound fine to me, so if you can kind of ignore an echo if you hear it and make your comment, okay. Ask a question, that'd be great.
All right. I'm very interested in the history of unions, because as a kid, I was taught that all unions were bad. My father was a corporate lawyer, and it's very hard for me to admit all this, but coming from the other side, what happened was I went to school with working class kids, and so I was really conflicted. And at one point, my mother called me a creeping socialist and all this stuff. And what you also described going on within the union, we've got class warfare within class warfare going on all the time. And I would like your comments on that and you know, where it all went wrong. How come in the 50s, the workers were focused by the corporations, and now it's the stockholders. So,
great.
Those are my comments, and I'll take them on the air.
Great. Thanks so much.
So, in response, I'm not somebody who's going to tell you that unions are better than people or worse than people, because unions are a bunch of people. So have there been corrupt leadership in locals? Yes. Do they last? Generally not. There's a fair amount of oversight of unions by the Department of Labor. They have to file all kinds of reports. And, it's highly regulated and highly investigated. So unions have less potential for being corrupt than fast food joints or shoe stores. They're very well regulated. And unions are not opposed to being regulated because it makes confidence higher. And there are elections, and people do get thrown out. And they're usually like, many unions have two parties in them, always vying for leadership. In OE3, there's the gold ticket and the green ticket, whatever. Of slates, and competition for leadership in unions is healthy, and it keeps things from getting totally swept under the rug. But I'm not going to say unions aren't bad sometimes. I mean, frankly, a lot of the labor movement took a big boost at the end of slavery in the North because trainloads of former slaves were being brought up to Chicago and Boston and whatever to break strikes. So did the unions end up racist? Pretty much. For a long time was one of the goals of organized labor to only have whatever the dominant ethnic group in that local actually get the work. You bet. Is that still true? Really not. And, you know, Chicago and Boston are good examples of it. In fact, the right-to-work movement, which is the movement about getting rid of agency shops and you know, mandatory fees for the union, was started by a guy in the Klan because unions were a place where African Americans were on equal footing with their white counterparts and their bylaws and the way they operated, and they didn't want to force white people to be in unions with black people. So there have always been both tendencies in organized labor. I mean, we like to sing We Shall Overcome in the union songs to make us sound all very open-minded, but a lot of it was protectionism for the skilled trades and white men. I don't think it's true even a little anymore if you look where the growth in unions are. If you look at the makeup of SEIU, which has been the fastest-growing union for some time now, it is pretty much dominated by women and minority members at this point. At the highest levels, it's not tokenism. So, unions aren't perfect by any measure. Withdrawing from the union doesn't make it better. People need to get in there and make sure it stays on track. I don't know what else to say.
Good. We have another call. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Linda?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I thought he was still talking. Yeah, thank you. The great show. And I mentioned,
do you have a radio
you mentioned
on?
That Joe was active in the Democratic Party, and I think the most important thing for unions and the country is that we, of course, get a Democrat elected this time, and I want to know what he thought about the struggle within the party between the progressive reformers and the Clintonoid, old guard, corporate-friendly, Wall Street-friendly wing, and what's going on the state level and the national level. And I'll take it on the air.
Great question.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, I can't even imagine an answer that would fit in the time remaining, but I'll give you some of my impressions. First of all, I was part of the reform movement in Chicago until I realized that the leaders I was working with in the reform movement was making deals with the regulars and not telling anybody. And at that point, I went over to work with the regulars because I wanted to get certain things done, like multiple channels in the cable agreement. Cable was coming to Chicago for the first time, and I wanted to get appointed to the commission. And I asked how I do that through the local ward leader, and he said, take these two precincts and turn them around. So I did, because I wanted to get public access to cable television. Because at a certain point, there's, you know, there's politics and then there's business. And the Democratic Party is business. Politics is what's happening in Venezuela. In the United States, the dominant stuff is not politics, it's business by other means. And so I am not above being involved in politics for transactional reasons to get programs through that I want. I am also an idealist. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I ran the registration drive that put the Green Party on the ballot in California in 91. Do the Democrats like that about me? Not much. But I'm still on the executive board of the state party because I want the right intellectual arguments made, but I also don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So am I trusted by anybody? Probably not. But I will work with those in power to make the changes I can and work against those in power to get people I agree with into positions simultaneously. And frankly, I think that's what Bernie Sanders does, and it's very difficult for him to walk that line as well. And I'm constantly challenged with, is it easier inside or outside? The struggle of, do you want to be inside the system trying to make it better, or will they just co-opt you, or do you want to be outside the system rallying and screaming? Well, I was outside at the 68 convention. I want to be inside at the 2020 convention, and I'd be happy to be outside in 2024 if I think that's better. So I don't have a one-size-fits-all. I think you have to constantly reevaluate the situation you're in, and what was true with Obama as president is not the same situation as with Trump. And what was true with Lyndon Johnson is not the same situation as with George W. Bush. Sometimes you can make more change inside, sometimes you can't, and you leave. I left under Clinton because I thought the Clintons were totally selling out Americans' workforce. I came back under George W. Bush. But there was nowhere else to go.
And do you see a particular direction that the party is moving? I imagine California and Northern California are some of the more progressive Democrats in the country, but maybe I'm wrong. Where do you see them moving?
Liberal, there's a lot of words. They mean different things to different people. There is not a progressive majority for people on the middle to rely on. So, you know, the phenomena I watch is somebody will write an article that says, the Illinois primary proves that moving to the center, Democrats can win moving to the center. Okay. I'll buy that. It proved that you could win moving to the center. I'll show you can prove moving to the left. You can win staying right where you are. I can prove that too. It's all true. The question is, how do you want to govern? Do you want to govern from the center, or do you want to govern from the left and have health care for everybody and home ownership and a safe sanitary rental unit not be beyond your reach? Do you want programs that actually put people first? Then don't run as a centrist, because centrists can win. Because frankly, you can win being a progressive. But there's always that dynamic. And as soon as the article comes out, all the progressives spend all day arguing about why the guy who wrote that article is wrong instead of focusing on electing people they agree with. And so we can spend a lot of time fighting with each other about the direction the party should go, thinking that is the same as making the party go in that direction. I'm encouraged that there are a lot of people actually finally working on making the party move in a more progressive direction rather than spending their time talking about how bad centrist Democrats are.
Okay, we've got another call. You're talking with Joe Wildman, labor representative and community organizer. This is Corporations and Democracy, and I'm Linda McClure. And hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for the show. This is wonderful. Trump complains about businesses, his rich friends, moving their operations offshore and is trying supposedly to reorganize that so that American labor will have something to do again. I see automation as a much more serious problem for American labor because, I mean, if a machine can do your job, they don't need you. What do you think about that?
Well, you're 100%, you're 500% right. You are infinitely right. So let me talk about that a little bit. The notion that you give a tax break to rich people and they'll create jobs is absolutely insane. The job of management in companies is to reduce the amount of labor costs. They don't take money they find and hire people just to give people jobs. They're not jobs programs. If they could make a profit with nobody working there, they would make a profit with nobody working there. Nobody takes the money and creates jobs. What they're creating with the money right now is automation. That's the direction, and it is eliminating jobs. And labor unions are stuck in a model of 50 years ago. They're stuck in the United Auto Workers model. They're stuck in the model of take Uber drivers, right? They want to organize Uber drivers. They think the first step you have to do is try to get Uber to become the employer so you'll have an employer to bargain with. And frankly, one of the main reasons people become Uber drivers is they don't want to be an employee of Uber. They want to be an independent contractor. And labor has not figured out how to organize independent contractors to have a better standard of living or how to collect dues from them to make that happen in large numbers. I mean, there is the Directors Guild and a number of organizations that collect dues and have a trust for health insurance and retirement for people who don't have a constant employer. But labor still hasn't wrapped its brain around getting to the model that is not a factory with a bunch of workers on the floor and an employer who you get recognition from and organize. So they haven't even moved into the independent contractor, computer programmer, itinerant workforce enough yet. What are they going to do? Organize robots? What organized labor needs to do is get that productivity is going up because the work is getting done by machines and not people. And capital hasn't figured out yet that machines are not going to buy their products. And organized labor needs to put a big part of their organizing capacity into getting things like national health care and housing programs, because the gross national product that will ultimately be produced by machines should not only benefit the people who own the machines. All the benefits shouldn't go to capital. It should go to the people of the United States. And the way you have to do that is by taxing production, you know, which won't eliminate production. That's crap. People still want to make a profit. And share that wealth by having subsidies for the necessities of life. Because right now, only the stockholders will benefit from automation, and the workforce will be poor. And I know I'm sort of rambling on, but when I was growing up, I remember the book that showed the robot mowing the lawn and the robot bringing the person drinks and the robot, you know, the future, right? And the guy sitting in a lawn chair drinking a martini and a robot's mowing the lawn. And I remember even then thinking, what does this guy do for a living? How can he afford the robot that mows the lawn? What work will people be doing? How will they get paid? And if we don't uncouple people's livelihood from other people employing them, we're going to have a really hard time when there's almost nobody working, because they're not going to be the idle rich. They're going to be the lumped and unemployed.
All right, we have about 9 minutes left, 8 minutes. If you want to call in, the number is 895-2448. So one of the attacks that public sector folks have been facing is attacks on their pension and on their medical benefits and other benefits. And part of that is a move to privatize public services, as private companies often pay less and offer fewer benefits. I know when Solid Waste of Willits took over from the county workers, the transfer stations, I asked one of the fellows at one of the stations, how do you like working for Solid Waste? And he said, well, it's lower wages and fewer benefits, but at least I'm working. And he seemed, you know, consoled by that. And I, of course, wasn't. It feels like a race to the bottom. What do you see in Mendocino County regarding privatization? What does that look like right now?
Well, you know, I think there's very little faith that government works. And people are exploiting that, because there's this myth that the private sector does it better. And all you have to do is walk around and see how many restaurants have been on the corner in Ukiah in the same location over a period of years. The private sector goes bankrupt often. You know, 7 years is a good long time for most businesses. And, you know, government agencies, about once every 20 years we read about one going bankrupt. I don't think the private sector is the solution. There are clearly things that government shouldn't do. So, for instance, I don't think Mendocino County should own $7 million worth of construction equipment. I think it's reasonable to contract with Granite Construction or somebody else to come in and do a specific project and have bids. I think they should have prevailing wage so that it's not lower than union wage and protections. But some things should be contracted out, but the work of the public should be done by public employees who the public controls, and the public should be good employers, because public employment sets the standard for employment. So we can't be saying we think employers aren't doing enough, they're not paying enough, but we're going to pay our workers dirt. So I think there's always pressure to privatize. I think we will probably mostly succeed in resisting it, because the times they've done it, it hasn't particularly worked. Adding profit for somebody to the overall side of the ledger, opposite of income, on these projects does not make it more affordable to taxpayers. Because in addition to paying people, and materials and the overhead, you're now putting money in somebody's private pocket for owning the company and not particularly adding any value. So, you know, I'm going to be fighting privatization as much as I can. There are cases where it makes sense. There are cases where it may make sense to privatize management, but keep, you know, which maybe they should have done with solid waste of Willis, but there was no reason to take people who had pensions and health care and put them at the mercy of solid waste of Willis. They could have remained county employees in a public retirement with public health care and have the county budget that and just pay the solid waste of Willis to run the facilities, to make the management decisions on operations, because clearly they didn't have anybody in county service who was doing that right. But that's different than privatizing the whole operation.
Okay, we have another call. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, Dorothy Dorman calling. Let me shut that radio off.
Yes, please
do. Hold on a second. I'd like to know what Mr. Wildman thinks of the mumbo-jumbo of the pot rules that the supervisors are themselves important to writing. And my neighbor, Tia Rodriguez, was on for an hour on the radio talking about the rigmarole she had to go through. They did legal, supposed to be legal. But, you know, you sign up at one point. Say you signed up on April the 25th for legalization. And then they changed the rules. Well, which did you sign up for? The rules as of the date you signed up for or the rules that they keep changing? I want to hear a comment on that.
Great. Thanks, Dorothea. So that's I guess, county politics to keep in the spirit of the show.
Let me say that that is the current problem du jour, and I don't even know that I care what I think. I do think they're making a mess of it. I'm not surprised they're making a mess of it, but I really have not delved into marijuana policy to the point where I can talk labor history, I can talk collective bargaining. I don't even care what I think about pot policy because I don't consider myself particularly enlightened and informed about it. I'm not a grower. I'm knocking on wood. I don't need medical marijuana, and I'm not a recreational marijuana user for the last 40 years. So it was really cheap when I used to smoke. So
that's because you don't recreate anymore.
I don't. I just work. So I'm not really someone to comment on it. You might have wanted to spout a little more because the caller obviously had opinions on it. I don't particularly have opinions on marijuana policy. I do know that it's a mumbo-jumbo. I don't think that's a misstatement. It's a mess.
Okay, well, we're coming up on the end of the hour. So, Joe, is there anything that you would say to union members and non-union members about worker solidarity and how they can participate?
Well, if you have a union, get more involved. And if you don't have a union, get a union.
How does one do that?
Huh?
How does one do that?
Well, you know, there's for one thing, talking to your coworkers is the place to start. You can decide you want a union, but a union is not one person. It's not even really lawful. Concerted action, collective bargaining, is a group activity. Now, the group can be two people. I mean, the National Labor Relations Act allows for two people to be considered engaging in concerted action. But if you don't bring your workers along, you're not starting out democratically. So if you think there are problems at work, you should get your coworkers together and say, let's found the Mumbo Jumbo Workers Association, the employees of that employer. We just want an association. We're not even going to charge dues. What we really want to do is organize a picnic, a softball game, and tell the manager that we want control of the thermostat because it's always too hot or too cold, and start trying to bargain. Now, you might get attacked because it's dangerous to start trying to bargain with your boss.
But you will
have the protection of the law if you can withstand it.
Joe Wildman, I'm going to pull an Amy Goodman on you now. We've got just a few more seconds left, so thank you so much, Joe Lewis Wildman, labor organizer and great guy.